Welcome to the 50 States High Pointing Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren, and our high pointer that we're speaking with today is Patty from Oregon. Patty, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for doing the podcast.
Yeah. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about how you got started in the outdoors and what got you high pointing?
Oh, wow. So I grew up out here in Oregon and in California. So very much a West Coast girl, and the outdoors are a huge part of the culture out here. So I grew up, you know, horseback riding and swimming and doing all those things. And in the summertime, our parents, my sisters and I, would go with our parents to, you know, longer camping trips, maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time to national parks and the like. And so we kind of got instilled with a love of the outdoors pretty early. And then, as I got to college, I was self-aware enough to know that I really didn't want to sit in an office, 40 hours a week. I wanted some sort of travel, some sort of adventure. And so ultimately I landed on joining the Army and, spent the next 21 years doing that. And it was a good fit for me. My first assignment was down in Panama. So I got to deploy a lot to Latin America. Wow. Where my unit was building roads and drilling wells. And I was scuba diving on the weekends. And, very much an outdoor kind of adventure. Met my husband in the Army. And we continued to do a lot of travel and overseas assignments. And, you know, had a family. And I think our son, by the time he was 5 years old, probably had been to more countries than a lot of Americans might want to visit. We just kind of continued to travel just as life, progressed. And then our time in the Army was coming to a close. So our plan was, to set up a home base somewhere, but we didn't know where. You know, we had never picked where we wanted to live. The Army picked it for us. Mm-hmm. And so, and the other factor there is I'm from the West Coast and my husband's from the East Coast, and our son was born kind of right in the middle in Kansas City. So we had ties to everywhere, but we didn't have a specific place we wanted to, definitely call home. So we decided we would essentially sell all of our stuff, buy an RV, and we spent the next 3 years from 2018 to 2021 just traveling around the United States. Seeing the country, showing our son all these, really fantastic places. And, one thing led to another. After 3 years, we did settle down here in Oregon, about an hour from where I went to elementary school.
Wow. But, and where in Oregon is that?
We're in Eugene, Oregon, which is where the University of Oregon is. It's kind of in the center of the state. You're about an hour and a half in the mountains, an hour and a half in the ocean, 2 hours from Portland, and you just kind of got a little bit of everything.
Perfect. What a fascinating life. And thank you for your service. That's so cool. So you did the RV thing after the Army.
We did. It was a really good way to show our son this country. When we started, we had no clue about high pointing. We didn't know what it was. We started from Kansas. Our last assignment was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And we were leaving in the summertime, so it was hot. So the number one goal was go somewhere cool. So we drove up to the Great Lakes and, did some time around there. Then we went up into Canada, because my husband's family is from Quebec. So we went and saw family up there, and we were looking at our itinerary as we came back to the U.S. and said, okay, where do you want to go next? What do you want to do next? And I had two things that were on my bucket list. I wanted to see Acadia National Park, which is gorgeous. And then I wanted to go to Baxter State Park, which, as many of your listeners will know, is where Katahdin is. Not because I was high pointing, but because I'd been really interested in long distance backpacking for a long time and hadn't really been able to do much of it because, the Army does not give you 6 weeks off, let alone 6 months off to go hike a trail. Mm-hmm. So, but I'd read so many trail memoirs and blogs and all these different things that were talking about Katahdin, this entire journey from Georgia to Maine, people were talking about Katahdin. And I just wanted to see it with my own eyes. I wanted to climb it. And so the three of us did. Wow. And that was our first high point, though we still, again, had no clue what we were doing. We hadn't heard of high pointing yet. Fast forward. As we go through New England and we end up just doing some fun hikes, we go up Mount Washington, we go up Mount Mansfield. And then in the fall, an article came out in Backpacker Magazine. A gal named Lauren Mooney wrote this article called Confessions of an Accidental High Pointer, where she talked about high pointing and kind of how she got into it. And I thought, man, that's pretty interesting. And with the story was a map, of course. And the map showed, you know, each of the state's high points and their names. And of course, you start scanning it and saying, oh, which ones have I done? Which, you know, where have I been? And you realize, hey, we just did three of these in the last month. That's pretty cool. And so we cut out the map and we put it on the refrigerator in the RV right next to our giant national parks magnet that has where all the national parks are at. And it said, okay, well, you know, maybe, you know, as we're traveling around and we're hitting these different states, if we're looking for something interesting to do, maybe we'll hit a high point. Maybe we hit a national park. It wasn't really serious at that point.
Right. That's always how it starts off. People just kind of put one foot in and then they go, well, I should probably finish this.
It is. And, you know, the following year, I wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail. And so, and, you know, my husband wanted to keep fishing. And so we said, okay, he and our son would stay in the RV while I hike the trail. And, you know, the Appalachian Mountains run right up the eastern seaboard. They're the highest, you know, parts of the East Coast. So it's not surprising that a lot of the high points are right along the Appalachian Trail. Mm-hmm. And I was able to hit eight of those high points while I was on the trail, or right before it. And, you know, your number starts at five and then it grows to eight and then it's 10. And you know, before you get down this roll, you know, before too long, it's 4 years later and you've got 46 high points in DC and you're just like, you're starting to look, what's the next challenge going to be?
Yeah. Yep. That's what everybody says. And I've noticed after talking to a lot of high pointers so far that we're people who like lists.
Yes.
It's high point, it's state addictive. High point lists, national parks. We want to check off county high points. And then for people who have completed the state high points, I always ask what's next. And they'll say maybe the Canadian provincial high points or prominence, the prominent peaks. But we're people who like the next goal and the next goal and the next goal. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
No. And, you know, I feel that same way as we did our last high point, which was Hawaii back last November. You know, you're summiting a pretty big mountain in a really beautiful location. And as I'm coming down, I feel happy and excited, but I also felt this sadness like, oh man, there's only a couple more left. What am I going to do next? And so for me, it was, hey, why don't I high point the counties in Oregon? Because it's such a diverse state. It's got you know, the Pacific Ocean. It's got mountains, volcanoes. The deepest canyon in the United States is not the Grand Canyon. It's Hell's Canyon right on the Oregon and Idaho border. And so, you know, it's a good way, in the same way that high pointing the states is a great way to learn your country and how diverse it is. High pointing your state does the same exact thing, just a little less driving.
Sure. And you've hiked quite a, we'll get into your trails later in the podcast for sure, but you know, you've probably seen more of individual states than people who live in those states. But like I said, we'll get to that later. I do want to go back to how this all kind of started after your time in the Army. So I know that when I was in the Army, and you seem to have had a more adventurous career. I was stuck in an office a lot, although I did deploy, and it is in the at the end of the day, it's a physical job, and so it gets you out. You have to stay in shape and, you know, be able to complete a number of physical tasks, and I loved that about the Army. But did you ever, like, sit at work and think, like, man, I wish I could be here. I wish I could be there. And maybe just kind of ruminate in your head a little bit, maybe plan some trips to the point where once you get out of the Army and you're free to do these things, you're just kind of like a bull out of the gate, just kind of rushing to do these things. And I ask that because I find that with a lot of veterans that I speak to, that they would think about all the things that they wanted to do when they got out of whatever branch of service they were serving in. And then once they get out, it's like, boom, there's no stopping them. they're going to check off all these things on their list.
Yeah, no, I certainly had a taste of that towards the end of my time. I had a little bit more flexibility. And in 2016, so maybe 2 years before I retired, I had been talking about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro for, I don't know, 20 years. It would always be that one thing, I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that. And finally, 2016, I said, okay, I'm just doing it. I'm doing it this year. I'm buying the tickets. I'm booking the trip. And my best friend went with me. And the two of us went out and did the Limosho route, which is one of the longer routes, figuring, look, if you're flying all the way to Africa, like, make it as big of a trip as you can, right? Like, don't go there, climb a mountain and immediately turn around. So we took the longest route we could. And then we had such a great time. The next year we went and we did a rim to rim to rim fast packing trip on the Grand Canyon, where you just, you start in the South Rim, you go down to the Colorado River, back up to the North Rim, and then turn around and do it all over again as fast as you can. And those are the kind of things that were kind of driving me, because I had compressed time, I'd do the biggest thing I could do in that time. But I think you find when you retire, you start out with that same mentality and you start moving too fast and you realize you're missing things and you're not seeing enough of what you want. So you have to either go back or, slow down.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the listeners who aren't in the military, we do get 30 days of paid leave each year. And so that's usually split into what we call block leave. And that's 15 days for one half of the year and then 15 days the other half of the year. And so, like you, Patty, I would also do as much as I could within a 15-day period.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But leading up to that 15-day period, I would think about it nonstop, probably talk about it, too much to my peers. But it would keep me going. It was something that I could, when the days got a little dark, I could really look at. But I remember being in Iraq, and I was in northern Iraq in Erbil, and the Iraqi high point, I could see it sometimes from our base. On a clear day, I could. And I didn't get out of the base very much. And so I would just look at it and go, okay, I don't do enough at home. I don't know why, but just seeing that mountain just made me think, I got to get out more when I get back.
Yeah.
Because this stuff is awesome. It's out there. Why don't I just go climb these peaks? Because when you can't get out there and you can only look at it, it makes you want to climb it even more. So the first thing I did when I got back was get on a guided summit to Rainier, and that was it.
Yeah, no, it's amazing when you have the time to think about it and to obsess over it. And I think that's kind of what the Appalachian Trail was for me.
Yeah,
I had spent a lot of time thinking and obsessing about long distance backpacking, reading all about the long trails in the United States and which one I was going to do first. And, obviously you can't do them all at once. The summer's only so long. I'm not so much a winter hiker. So you start to prioritize. And I think, very much so.
Well, another benefit to having such a long-term goal like that is that you have to stay in shape if you want to complete those goals. And a lot of people think, oh, by the time I'm able to retire, I'm not going to be able to do these things. And granted, you can retire early in life from the military compared to other occupations. But it is a really good goal to have to stay healthy, stay in shape so that you can do the things that you've always wanted to do in life.
Yeah. Well, high pointing is one of those great things because it's just so inclusive. You can do it if you have a family, you can do it if you're really super fit. There's a wide variety of the peaks. So, obviously like summer drive up. So they're accessible for everybody, regardless of their abilities or disabilities. Others, maybe you're pushing your child as they get a little bit older to try something a little bit harder, and you can do it together, within their skill set. Most people aren't going to take, an 8-year-old up Rainier, but you could take an 8-year-old up, a lot of these other peaks that are pretty interesting. You could go out to the Black Hills and go up, Black Elk Peak.
Right. So can you talk a little bit more about high pointing with your family? Were they on board? What did your son think? What did your husband think? Are they like, mom's crazy, but we'll follow her?
Oh, So we did a lot of them as a family. Keith, my husband, he's done 33 of them with me. So we have done quite a few together, and our son has done 26 with us. Some of them we intentionally didn't take him along, not because he wasn't capable, but because we wanted a trip to Hawaii without him. Or, some that he really surprised me with his ability. You know, when we did Katahdin, he was 11 years old, and that's a pretty hard hike. I won't lie. When we went up, Wheeler Peak, it was a year later. And again, that's 13,000 feet, and it's a pretty adventurous hike. And I could just see the pride, in him as he was, when you're the kid, you're usually in the middle, you got one parent in the front of you leading the way, and you got one parent in the back nudging you along, making sure you don't fall behind. And, when you get to that summit and you see, the pride that he made it, he didn't even realize that he was, getting to the top maybe because he was just kind of following the pack in front of him, if you will.
Yeah.
And then you stop and you look around, and it's pretty amazing. It's amazing to see that through your child's eyes.
So can you talk about some of your most memorable high points? Now, of course, Katahdin was a big high point for you and your family, and obviously the high points along the Appalachian Trail. What were some memorable high points that you didn't really expect to be memorable?
I would say I have probably two that work together. Colorado, I take that back. It was Kansas and Oklahoma. And so we were in the RV still. I was able to find a really inexpensive ticket from where we were in Houston to go up to Colorado to do the two high points together in, late January, which, seems like an unusual time to do them. But yeah, the weather was cooperating until it wasn't. And so there was a huge snowstorm in Denver the day that before I flew out. And most of the snow had been cleared off I-25. But, the further you got away from Denver, the worse the roads got. And my plan had been fly into Denver, get a rental car, drive down to Oklahoma, grab Black Mesa down there, which is kind of in the panhandle of Oklahoma, spend the night somewhere, and then drive up to Kansas's High Point, which is just over the Colorado-Kansas border, and then drive back to Denver. So it was going to be a very quick trip. And again, the snow was a little bit more challenging as I got away down onto some more remote roads. And so I didn't get down to Black Mesa, to the trailhead, until almost dusk. And, I've got beautiful sunset pictures. They're gorgeous. But, I'd made this trip and I was going to go, even if I had to go in the dark. And so, the sun goes down. And for those of your listeners who haven't been out there yet, you kind of have a trail that goes for a couple of miles, and then you have a steep escarpment that you go up on a trail. But, it's very steep. And then you get up to the top of the mesa and you have to walk maybe another mile to the monument. So I'm walking along in the dark, listening to the, coyotes howling, and I get to the escarpment, and I'm kind of, watching where the snow is, making my way up. And all of a sudden, it's like somebody's got this bright flashlight shining in my eyes. And I'm like, what is going on? Is there somebody else out here? And what it is I'm cresting the escarpment, and it's a full moon. And it was the moon that was, starting to rise. And so once I got up there, I was able to turn off my headlamp and walk all the way to the monument in the dark with just under the moonlight, under the stars. And that was pretty remarkable. It wasn't the way I had intended it to be, but, it certainly was a memorable high point. And then I continued the trip on to Kansas. And I got up early in the morning, so I'm driving across the plains, and it's, completely covered in snow, and I get this beautiful sunrise, and I'm still fretting, am I going to get down that road that Kansas's High Point is on private land, and so you go down a kind of a long road, particularly if you're approaching from the south. And I got, pretty much up to the cattle guard, and then I'm kind of trudging through the snow. But it was beautiful. I mean, most people have Kansas's High Point when it's summertime and it's green, and I have it when it's snowy and 3 degrees. So certainly memorable.
Right. And probably unexpected, especially with the full moon and that light. That's incredible.
It was absolutely gorgeous. I would Sometimes. Recommend that once you have the skills to do them outside, you know, the typical time, get a sunset or a sunrise climb, you know, because it will stick with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's those high points where we don't have expectations going into it that exceed the expectations that we never had.
Absolutely.
And you're right about the sunrise and the sunset. As I was telling you on our phone conversation before this, my most memorable high point is Mount Whitney, because I did the Mountaineers route and I was a guided summit, and we just weren't in a rush. And so we took our time. Mm-hmm. I woke up in the morning. We were on the mountain for two nights, I think. And I just got to watch the sunrise come over the Sierras. And then as soon as we were done with our breakfast and coffee, we went up. And I'm like, this is just so relaxed. The pace is chill. And we get to watch the sunrise and then we get to watch it set. And it was just me, my husband, and our guide, and he was super awesome. And so conversation was great. The nature was beautiful. And like that moment, or those moments, are what I remember. Of course, I have pictures from the summit, but that wasn't the thing that stuck out about that mountain. It was the moments in between the trailhead and the summit, I think.
Yeah, I find that sometimes who you go with makes a huge difference too.
Yes.
There's some high points that I'm glad that I did them solo. And there's mm-hmm. others, you know, when I went out to do Gannett Peak last summer, I actually went with a Knowles group. Knowles is a National Outdoor Leadership School. And mm-hmm. I had done the 80-hour wilderness first responder course through them. And one of the instructors was from Wyoming. He was a climber, and he was very much into a lot of the peaks out in Wyoming. And so I was asking him, I was just picking his brain during one of our breaks, you know, who should I go with? I'm not sure I have the skills for Gannett. You know, what routes are good? You know, just trying to get the basics of that from him. And he said, you know, once you finish this course, you're going to be an alumni of Knowles. And we do an alumni trip every summer. So people who graduated from other Knowles courses kind of get together. It's a little more low threat of an environment, but you're still learning things. You're still learning, you know, how to self-arrest and do rope travel and, you know, perfect your skills with crampons. And so that was just a fantastic trip to do with them. It was a larger group than I'd ever gone up a high point with, because the only other guided kind of trips I had done were, I went up Bora with a guide, and then I went up Mount Hood with a guide, and then I had an unsuccessful summit of Mount Rainier with a guide. And so this was a completely different dynamic, though, than any mm-hmm. of those other trips, because everybody was there learning. Everybody who was coming into it with kind of a very open mind, but a willingness to learn as opposed to be led. And so it created a completely different dynamic that I really appreciated.
So apart from Katahdin, which is your favorite high point?
I love New Mexico. I'm a sucker for the desert, personally. I love all the Four Corner states. But when we did Wheeler Peak, we went in October. So all the aspens had turned gold. There was hardly anybody there. We had a bluebird kind of day. It was cold and windy, but the skies were completely clear. And the photos we got on Wheeler Peak were just utterly gorgeous. I had somebody reach out to me later who asked, you know, if they could purchase one of the photos for a nonprofit. They were putting out their quarterly or annual report to their donors, and they wanted to purchase a photo to put as part of the report that they were sending out, just because it was an unusual time of year to see Wheeler Peak.
Yeah. Wow. Wheeler's one of my favorite high points too. I love that part of New Mexico. I mean, Taos is gorgeous. And when I was there, it was the off season, obviously, for Taos Ski Resort. And so not a lot of people were there. I mean, I was like one of the only ones on that trail. And it was so quiet, but you could hear the wind kind of whispering through the trees. And you see wildlife, too. But it was just such a beautiful experience, and I did it alone. And like you mentioned, there are some peaks that you're glad you did alone, not in, I don't know. I mean that in a good way. Of course I would have gone with other people too. It just happened to be that I was by myself, and I'll never forget it, 'cause it was such a special moment that I had just by myself. Although it wasn't an easy hike. No. I did it shortly after Rainier, and I remember kind of like huffing and puffing towards the top and thinking like, what is wrong with you, Lauren? Like, you've climbed higher, like get yourself together. But once you get past the tree line, it gets pretty serious in terms of the angle, you know.
Absolutely.
It is a walk up at the end of the day.
Well, you know, if you have another one that didn't go quite as expected, you know, in the military, we have this saying that you make a plan, but the enemy gets a vote. Mm-hmm. And in the enemy in most of high pointing adventure seems to be the weather.
Yeah.
And so, and maybe this is a cautionary tale as well that some of your listeners might appreciate. But when I went out to do King's Peak, it was 2020. I had the intention of doing it alone. You know, we were driving around still in the RV and really trying to remain socially distanced. So we were, you know, going to North Dakota, South Dakota, you know, all the Great Plains. And we got to northern Utah, and I decided rather than taking the traditional route to King's Peak, I wanted to hike it as part of the Uinta Highline Trail. And for your listeners, that's a 105-mile trail in northern Utah that goes to the High Uinta Wilderness. So you start on, I was starting on the east side, and it was going to be 55 miles until I got to King's Peak. And then you go up and over Anderson Pass, which is right next to King's Peak. And then it was another, you know, 50 miles or so till I got to the other end of the trail. So it was going to be, you know, a multi-day trip. And in addition to that, I'd been watching the weather forecast, and this time of year, it was, you know, right around Labor Day, just before Labor Day, and the wildfires were going. It was up in the upper 90s. It was unseasonably hot in Utah, but I could see in the forecast, the long range forecast for what it's worth, that there was a polar vortex coming, and it was going to drop the temperature of 40, 50 degrees on me. So I would be, you know, starting the trail at when it was in the 90s. And then, you know, it would probably drop into the 50s, you know, and down to freezing temperatures at night. So, you know, you're packing what you need for a warm hike, what you need for a cold hike. And one of the things that I bring with me when I do a solo trip is I bring a Garmin InReach Mini, which is a little satellite responder. It allows me to kind of text my husband each night, kind of give him a proof of life message, if you will, that I'm still alive and moving. It also has an SOS button on it in case, you know, you break your leg 10 miles from a trailhead. You know, you can rescue yourself by calling, you know, for a rescue. And so, you know, I began this trail, you know, feeling like I was in pretty good shape in terms of the conditions that I knew would be there. And, you know, everything was going along fine. You know, the end of day three, I get up to the pass. I drop my pack. I go up to King's Peak. You know, I'm really proud of myself. And it's, and again, like you said earlier, it's one of those ones that I really enjoy doing by myself. It was hard, but it was beautiful. And I was the only person on the mountain that day because Labor Day weekend had just happened. So everybody who had been out there for Labor Day was already, you know, gone back front country. And so I was the only person out there. And, you know, when I got to the top, you know, often when you're in the back country, you've got, you know, your cell phone in airplane mode so that it's not running down the battery looking for cell towers that aren't there. And so I will often at a high point turn my cell phone back on though, just to, you know, send a text or check the weather. And so I wanted to know, you know, is this, you know, polar vortex still coming my way? And confirmed that it was, and now there was some precipitation too. So, you know, Park City was the closest city. So I'm seeing there might be some wintry mix that night with some rain or some sleet or some snow, but it'll be over by 8:30 in the morning and I can continue my hike. And so I come down from Anderson Pass and go a couple more miles, and I set up my tent, and I intentionally put myself kind of in this little cluster of trees, and there's not a lot out there because you're in this high valley. And, you know, I go to sleep and I hear the pitter patter of rain on my tent. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, here it is. Couple hours later, just after midnight, I wake up, you know, bladder is full. So I get outside my tent and the storm had stopped and there's now maybe 2 inches of snow on the ground, like that big fluffy snow, like everything is coated. Full moon, just like in Oklahoma. It's gorgeous. And I, you know, I knocked the snow off my tent and I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be a little bit rough, you know, finding the trail, because this is not like the Appalachian Trail where you've got blazes on the trees. Like, this is some serious orienteering going on out here. And, you know, I went back to sleep. About 5:30 in the morning, I start to feel a wet coldness on my face. And I'm like, what is going on here? And the storm had picked up again. There was more snow. This time it was that icy type of snow. And it was coming down, like really coming down. And it was blowing at least 20 miles an hour at this point, blowing the snow sideways. So it's getting under the fly and into my tent. And I had one of those trekking pole tents where you use your poles as kind of like the main support. So, you know, I'm trying to kind of jimmy rig this, you know, lower the tent a little to kind of get it closer to the ground. But the wind is so heavy, it's literally blowing my tent over. And I'm like kind of huddled in the dry side of my tent going, okay, you just got to wait a couple more hours. The sun will come up, the snow will end, and you'll figure it out. And, the snow didn't end. The snow didn't end at 8 o'clock. It didn't end at noon. At some point, I'd moved my tent to get it more shelter, but the wind kept shifting. And so I said, you know, I know there's a lake about 2 miles from here. That might be all I hike today, is that 2 miles. But I'm going to get near the lake, because every lake I'd been to had all these, you know, like a forest of trees around. And that's for sure to block the wind. And I, you know, very slowly, I mean, I had every piece of clothing on. I didn't, you know, I wasn't prepared for snow. I was prepared for cold, but not snow. So I'm putting my feet, you know, my socks inside Ziploc bags, and then putting my feet in my shoes to try to keep them dry. You know, I've only got like, you know, mitten type gloves that are fabric. And I make it over the pass. And I could only maybe see 20 feet ahead of me at any given time. So I'm so grateful I had a GPS route for this, you know, this hike. And I finally get to the lake and there's no trees. There's like 4 trees. And so I set up again and I'm kind of dry. And things went from bad to worse. Long story short, you know, when I was going over the pass, the snow was already almost up to my knees at that point. So we're talking some serious snow coming down, and it continued to snow. And I knew that my sleeping bag was starting to get wet. And if when a down sleeping bag's wet, it's useless. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a whole lot I could do to keep my tent up in that wind. And, you know, as humbling as it was, I knew that, you know, my hands were the tips of my fingertips were white all the time. I was getting frost nip on them. It was time to get myself out of this situation. And I actually had to press the SOS button and effect a rescue. And things did not go as planned. They actually made 3 rescue attempts to get me off the mountain. The same things that were keeping me from getting out were the things that were keeping them from getting in. Sure. And the, you know, the helicopter got within 1.5 miles of me the first time, and then the pilots had to turn back because the conditions were so bad. And for could your you listeners who don't know, I could hear it, but I could not see it. Wow. I thought, you know, I thought my ears were actually playing a trick on me, because I knew I was, you know, I was messaging back and forth with the local sheriff who was in charge of the rescue, and another great reason to have this device, to not kind of know what's going on as you can communicate your conditions to them. And, you know, he had told me, hey, the helicopter's taking off. It's going to take 20 minutes to get to your position. Don't move. You know, that's the thing with a rescue. You don't move. They know where you're at. Don't move. Mm. And then when they were about 10 minutes out, he said, okay, I want you to go to an open area nearby so the helicopter can land, and you will signal it with the light when you know, it gets close. So I'm sitting out in this open area with, you know, no protection from the storm that is, you know, 20, 30 mile per hour winds and snow. The snow is, you know, above my knees now. I've got my tent wrapped around me. I'm shivering out there waiting for this helicopter. And, you know, you're hearing the wind. You're hoping for the noise of the helicopter. You hear the noise and you're thinking, is this just my muscle memory from my years in the military that I'm hearing helicopters, or am I really hearing the helicopter? And then I got a message from him saying the pilot just had to turn around. Keep yourself warm. Stay safe. We're still coming for you.
Wow.
And their backup plan to get me was to send horses in. The closest trailhead was 20 miles away. And he told me the horses are still headed your way. It's going to be probably another 6 or 8 hours before they get there. You know, stay warm. You know, do what you have to do to keep yourself alive. And I'm thinking, first off, 8 hours in to get with his horses means 8 hours out on the horses. And Oh my gosh. Well, unbeknownst to me, you know, the horses got to the trailhead and the snow was so bad that after a quarter mile, they refused to continue on. So the horses were not coming.
Wow.
So around midnight, there was a break in the storm and the helicopter, the pilots came back out again. They were able to land. The one pilot stayed with the helicopter and the other one came to get me. And he's now, you know, upper thigh deep in snow coming my way to, you know, to my position before he yells at me to grab my stuff and go. And of course, my hands are in a pretty bad condition when I get to the helicopter. He's got to buckle me in and everything. And they fly me to the front country and I go to Park City, which thank goodness it's a ski area. So they are, you know, totally prepared to deal with hypothermia and frost nip and frostbite and chilblains and everything else that was, you know, plaguing me. Wow. And I, you know, I'm eternally grateful for the people who saved my life ultimately.
What were you thinking during those longer periods when you were waiting and they had to turn around and then the horses didn't do it?
Oh my gosh. I think this is where the military kind of comes in to help you. You know, I'm one of those people that when big things happen and big things go wrong, I become very calm, you know, maybe rely on your training. It's the little things, you know, my son not putting the toilet seat down that, you know, causes me to fly off the handle, the helicopter not, you know, making it. I'm like, okay, what happens next? You know, What happens next? How do we get out of this next? And, you know, just kind of remaining calm with that. And because you know, panicking's not gonna help.
And there wasn't much you could do.
No, you work in 15-minute increments. Stay warm for the next 15 minutes. Okay, you're still alive. Stay warm for the next 15 minutes until you know. And the sheriff that was working this rescue was really good about communicating to me about what was going on and, you know, making sure that I was okay. And that's part of the reason why I did that Knowles trip to become a wilderness first responder, because that had such an impact on me. Not only to get the skills that, you know, would continue to keep me safe or somebody else that I might be with, but, you know, to be able to pay it forward.
Wow. So what would you have done differently?
I think the biggest thing I could have done differently, because I certainly wasn't going to bring snowshoes on a 90-degree hike, I probably could have delayed my hike. You know, I saw this bad weather coming. I thought to myself, look, you've hiked in bad weather so many times. You've had these conditions. It's going to be fine. You're prepared. I'd already done my Appalachian Trail through hike. I'd done a lot of other long distance hikes at that point. But, you know, in hindsight, you know, you really do have to pay attention to the weather. People lose their lives to the weather.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So when you said that, you know, you had a memorable experience, I did not see that coming.
Well, it's humbling more than anything because nobody wants to be rescued. But the reality is, you know, we also should talk about these things because everybody in the back of their mind probably thinks that the person who's been rescued was unprepared or, you know, in over their head, didn't have skills to be doing what they should have been doing. And that just wasn't the case for me. I was prepared for this. I did have the skills. but circumstances just were not in my favor at that point. And these were, these were the types of things that could have happened to anybody.
Yeah. And you seem like a very self-sufficient person, and I'm sure that it was difficult to hit that SOS button, but did it go through your mind that if I don't hit this, I could just die out here?
There was a point where I said, look, it's starting to get dark now. You know, how much worse could it get? And there are no posthumous medals for hypothermia. You know, no. you have a partner, you have a child, you have people that you love and who love you at home, and you've got this resource that, you know, it could make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. You know, what would you advise your son if he was in the same situation?
That's a good way to look at it.
That button, or would you want him to tough it out and potentially lose his life?
Sure. Wow. I mean, what a great thing to have in the wilderness then. Was that device?
Yeah, it definitely goes with me in the backcountry on every hike, and even high points. You know, because you think about it, you're going out to a high point in a remote location. Let's say you're going to Nevada's high point. You're not going to have cell service. If something happens to you, from your car breaking down to some sort of physical injury, are you in a position to move forward, or are you going to be walking 20 miles for help?
Wow. So let's transition now to your longer hikes. Seems like a good segue. You've obviously done the Appalachian Trail, which is huge. Are your next goals the PCT, the Continental Divide? Are you trying to be a Triple Crown hiker?
I'm not sure that I definitely want to be a Triple Crown hiker, just because, you hike these long trails and they take a lot of your life to do. They take an entire season. There's nothing else you're doing that season but hiking that trail. Mm-hmm. And I do love the other trails, but I also want to have a little bit of a life. And I also want to do the thing that I'm most inspired by in the moment. So some of the other trails that I've done that I was really inspired to do in the moment, where I went to Spain to do a couple of the different Camino de Santiago routes. I did the Camino Frances and the Camino del Norte, walking across the entire country of Spain. So that's, for your listeners, about 500 to 550 miles, depending on the route. Mm-hmm. I did the Arizona Trail last spring, which is 800 miles from the Mexico border to the Utah border. One closer to home that I did was they have the Oregon Coast Trail, which runs around the entire coastline from Washington to California. This is not a beach walk. You're not like walking Southern California beaches for 400 miles. You're going over forested headlands and past lighthouses. And that one's different because you also have to time the tides, because there are places that you cannot get around except at low tide. And so you're really having to be mindful about, you don't just get up in the morning and just walk the miles you want to walk. You go and look at the tide tables and figure out, okay, where can I get today? What do I need to be? Where do I need to be at 1 o'clock, type of mindset. But the entire
Oregon, how long did that take?
I did it in three sections. So it took me all told about 5 weeks, but I came home, for a couple days between each of the sections. So I think it took me a total of 24 days, because I did three, like eight day sections. But the entire Oregon coastline is public. So there is no private land blocking your access to the coast. Somebody who's got a house right on the beach cannot block you from walking in front of it. Yeah. So it's the only state where the entire coastline is public.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you mentioned in our conversation before this recording that you were going to do a section of the Pacific Crest Trail through Oregon. Now, is that upcoming?
Yes. So I've got... my second attempt at Rainier planned in just about 2 weeks' time. I got halfway up it and we got weathered off last year. So I'm going to go back out and do that. And then 2 days later, a friend of mine and I are going to hike the entire Oregon section of the Pacific Crest Trail, which is, about 450, 500 miles.
Now, does that timing line up with when the PCT hikers would be hitting Oregon?
It does. Although this year, maybe not, because it was such a high snow year that a lot of the hikers are going to hike as far north as they can to the Sierras, and then they're going to flip up to the Canadian border and hike south back down to give the time for the Sierras to thaw. Anybody that would normally be coming through, though, will be getting, usually hitting the Oregon border around, you know, July. So, you know, there might be quite a few PCT hikers out there.
Oh, that's fun. Wow. So now you have a website, Outdoor Pilgrim, where you chronicle all of these journeys that you go on, high pointing and trails. Can you talk to listeners about how you formed that and what was the thought behind it and how they can access it?
Sure. It's Outdoor Pilgrim, like a pilgrim from Thanksgiving. It's something that I started right when we started our travels. And so the goal really initially was just to put things on there from our travels, just for our family. Mm-hmm. And the first, as I said, long distance hike that I was doing after I got out of the Army was the Camino de Santiago, which is a medieval pilgrimage route in Spain to Santiago de Compostela. And the people, as they're walking the route, are called pilgrims. They're on a pilgrimage to this point. And so, you know, that combination of the love of the outdoors and just kind of being on a pilgrimage to see more of it, if you will, not necessarily a religious or spiritual pilgrimage like a lot of people, but more of an outdoor pilgrimage, if you will.
That's so fascinating.
So I post my trail journals there. I post all my trip reports for my state and county high points there, just so other people who might be interested can see, okay, this is what it was like, you know, or this is, you know, what it might be for me to go on this journey. I might want to, you know, have information about the parking or the, you know, are there bathrooms at the trailhead? And, you know, what route did this person take? You know, all those, you know, little details that somebody might want.
Yeah, the Arizona Trail is on my bucket list for one day. So I definitely looked through that section, and it's very detailed. You have a lot of pictures, and there's the descriptions are perfect, and it's a helpful resource. So I will provide that link in the show notes for the podcast and the YouTube channel.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you for that. Now, you're also an historian of high point names.
Yes.
What piqued your interest in that niche subject?
Well, like a lot of things on this episode, it comes back to Utah. as I prepare these trip reports, you know, I want to try to make them as accurate as I can, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, because I kept seeing King's Peak, and sometimes I'd see it Kings, like plural, like We Three Kings, and sometimes I'd see it King apostrophe S.
Okay.
And I know that the Board on Geographic Names does not like apostrophes and names, but they exist out there. Martha's Vineyard has an apostrophe in there. So what is, you know, what was the story with King's Peak? And so as I was trying to, you know, decipher this journey, I realized that through some, you know, a little bit of sleuthing on the internet and research, that King's Peak was named after Clarence King, who was a famous geologist in the late 1800s. And he was with Josiah Whitney as he was out there surveying the Sierras. In fact, he's the one who suggested that Mount Whitney be named Mount Whitney. And mm-hmm. he was extremely well known. There was this thing called the Great Diamond Hoax back in the 1870s. And he proved that it was a hoax, and it was this huge Ponzi scheme that was, you know, it's like the Bernie Madoff of the 1870s is what was going on there. And he exposed it and had this international acclaim of, you know, showing that this diamond mine didn't really exist and that they were just taking people's money. And so he was very famous, you know, the kind of famous that you dine at the White House type of famous. And mm-hmm. he fell in love in the late 1880s with a woman named Ada Copeland. And Ada was a Black woman, and he is a white man of privilege, you know, went to Yale and grew up in Rhode Island. And the laws of the time, you know, did not allow for them to get married. And so what he did is he decided to pass the color line. You know, you hear sometimes stories about people that are lighter skinned that were passing as white in order to, you know, get the privileges that were being denied to them. He went the other way, and he tried to pass himself off as an African-American or biracial man.
Wow.
And he led this entire double life with a completely different name, James Todd, with Ada Copeland. They were common law married, had five children together, and he told her that he was a Pullman porter because that was a very common job for light-skinned African-American men at the time, and that would explain his time away, where he, you know, and then in the meantime, he's off being this world-famous geologist and leading this entire double life for 20 years.
Wow. Wow.
And so I thought to myself, man, if the story behind King's Peak is that interesting, what are the stories behind some of these other peaks? I mean, probably most of them aren't quite that interesting, but some of them might be. And so, and King's Peak was my 23rd peak. So at that point, now I had to kind of go back and start doing the research that I had done before. And, you know, I kind of got into it.
Well, you're right. It sure is fascinating. And are they as fascinating as Utah's?
I think a lot of them are. I'm certainly inspired and interested in any of the ones who have changed names. I mean, most of us know about Denali and Black Elk Peak changing their names.
Yeah.
Most people don't know that Mount Whitney almost changed its name. Back in 1881, a bill came up in front of the California legislature and it passed and went to the governor's desk to rename the peak after the three fishermen of Owens Valley, who were the first three to summit then Whitney. Whitney never made it to the top. King actually thought he made it to the top, but he made it to the top of the next peak over. And so the first three people to go up were these three fishermen. And so this bill went through the legislature to name it Fisherman's Peak. And it made it to the governor's desk on April 1st, and he thought it was an April Fool's joke.
No.
And so he vetoed it. And so for most people who have been up to Whitney, you've been inside that little hut that's at the top. There's like a little stone hut, and there's a sign in there that says, "Welcome to Fisherman's Peak." And that's why.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. This is, I feel like we could have another episode about just the names. I mean, just these two stories that I've heard are so fascinating.
Can I give you one more?
Absolutely.
Okay. I love the story behind Tennessee and North Carolina.
Okay.
Most people know that Mount Mitchell is named after Elisha Mitchell because there's a grave at the top there for him. He was a University of North Carolina professor. And he discovered that that peak there was actually, at the time, it was called Black Bald. And he discovered that it was 500 feet higher than Mount Washington, which was thought to be the highest point east of the Mississippi at the time. And so Mount Mitchell was higher, significantly higher, or Black Bald, as it was called back then. And he kind of got into a very public dispute with a man named Thomas Clingman from Tennessee. And Thomas Clingman had been one of his pupils. He went on to become a general in the military and then a U.S. senator. And Clingman very publicly said, "No, Smokey Bald here in Tennessee is taller." And Clingman is kind of a very obnoxious character. He had already gotten into one feud with another senator that led to a duel and ultimately apologies when both of them missed. And so Clingman gets into this very protracted public debate with Mitchell, which was actually known as the Mitchell-Clingman debate, about which is higher, Smokey Bald or Black Bald. And when Mitchell decided to, he was a more quiet and reserved person. So he decided at the age of 65, "I'm just going to go back up and measure it again." And that's where he fell to his death. And that was ultimately buried on the University of North Carolina campus and then later moved. Ultimately, what ends up happening is a Swiss surveyor and a Princeton professor, he goes out there and he measures both of them. and proves Mitchell right. Klingman's dome is 41 feet shorter. So Klingman's dome or Smoky Dome then is renamed in Klingman's honor as a consolation prize. And ultimately, the taller of the two, Black Bald, is named in Mitchell's honor.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That is so interesting.
I mean, these stories are fascinating and they're parts of our history that, you know. So this is why I'm working currently on a book on about all the High Points names. Hopefully that'll come out here maybe in the next year.
Please share your progress on the book and definitely when it comes out, because I know that the listeners are going to want to get their hands on that.
So here's a story behind General Humphreys. So it's A.A. Humphreys is often how you'll see his name. He was a surveyor. He was an engineer. He ultimately became the chief of engineers for the Army.
He was an Army officer.
After the Civil War. Okay. And as he was working out west doing all the surveyor, the person that he worked for was none other than Jefferson Davis. And so when the Civil War went off, there were a lot of questions about where was his loyalty. Was it to the Union or was it to Jefferson Davis? Ultimately, he proved himself quite valiantly. He was on the front lines with his troops and ultimately, you know, promoted to general and then became the first chief of engineers for the Army. So, and of course, somebody who would work under him later, doing a lot of the surveying out west for the railroads, would be Wheeler of Wheeler's Peak fame.
Okay.
So a surveyor. So that's the story behind Humphreys.
It is interesting to see how these High Point names are also connected between Tennessee, North Carolina, Absolutely. And then Arizona, New Mexico. I want to read more about it now. So you got to hurry up with that book.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure you get the first copy.
So before we go, I like to ask listeners two questions. The first is, what are some of your favorite outdoor adventure books, documentaries, or podcasts?
Ooh, that's a good one. Well, obviously, I love the book about Clarence King. There's a Princeton professor who wrote a book called Passing Strange. That's about him. And so that was certainly on the top of my list of books. There's another one out there that was written by a guy named Rinker Buck. And he wrote a book called Oregon Trail. And he and his brother decided to recreate the journey west on the Oregon Trail. They bought mules. They had an Amish craftsmen build them an actual wagon, and then they went and recreated a couple of years back, this is probably a decade back, the journey across the western U.S.
Wow.
That many people took as they moved from the middle of the country to the western part of the country, either on foot or by wagon. And so that was pretty darn fascinating.
Yeah. I enjoy Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose. Lewis and Clark as they headed west. And that was a really, I mean, it's straight from their journals, basically. Mm-hmm. And
the thing I really liked about Rinker Buck's book is that he does a good job of weaving his modern day adventure going with his brother in the mules. And then he takes things from the journals of the people who were seeing that and talking about the significance of certain things, like why you needed to make it to Independence Rock by the 4th of July, which is how it got its name.
Yeah.
I think that was a good way to tell the story.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to have to check that out. And, you know, another thing I like about Undaunted Courage is the botany aspect, because I think Meriwether Lewis was the botanist, right? In general,
I don't
Clark
know
was,
which was which. I always get them confused.
I think Lewis was the botanist and Clark was the like military leader of the duo or something like that. But so you get that scientific portion of the whole reason why they were going out there was just to see if stuff is fertile and if you could really grow things out there. And that's awesome.
Just the idea of going somewhere that a lot of people, you know, didn't even know existed. You know, the whole western part of the U.S. was so unexplored by Anglos at the time that, you know, they had no idea what lay beyond the Mississippi.
Right. And that's why Undaunted Courage is the perfect title for that book.
Absolutely.
You don't know what you're getting into, but you just go anyway.
You know, another book that I absolutely love, that might seem unusual, but, you know, as we were traveling around, and we were homeschooling our son because, you know, we were traveling full time, mm-hmm. and we were doing our little block of history, and I had him read the book called Desperate Passage. And Desperate Passage was a story of basically the Donner Party, and not the sensational mm-hmm. cannibalism part, sure. but why were they going west? Why did they take this particular cutoff? How is it that they got themselves in this situation that was so dire, and who was looking for them too? And telling the stories, not only the members of the party, but the people who were going to try to save them. Ultimately.
Wow. What was that called?
It's called Desperate Passage.
Okay. Wow. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, that's another one. If you like an adventure, but you're not looking for necessarily a, you know, climbing a mountain type of adventure, most of us think we know the story, and then you read it and you're like, wow. Okay. Right. I see. I didn't know anything about this.
Wow. Well, the last question I'd like to close out with are, what are the benefits on a personal level that you and your family have gotten from high pointing and, in your case, getting out there and seeing the country?
You know, I think you probably had a lot of guests say this, but, you know, seeing parts of the country that you might not have otherwise visited mm-hmm. is a huge aspect of it, because whether it's the journey to get to the high point or where the high point is actually located, it takes you off the beaten path. It takes you off the interstates. It pushes you out, you know, maybe try local cuisine or talking to local folks. And, you know, part of it too is also, you know, we see a lot of divisiveness every single day when we watch the news. And then you travel and you realize that most of us are far more alike than we ever give each other credit for. And it kind of restores your faith in humanity, if you will. And that's a lot to put on top of high pointing, to restore that's everybody's true, faith in humanity. But, you know, that's at least where it's taken me.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Tune in every Monday to hear new stories from High Pointers. For more information on the official High Pointers Club, visit highpointers.org. To contact the editors of the High Pointer Club magazine, Apex to Zenith, email newsletter@highpointers.org.